today, we got the latest from Serie A with draws galore, Juve sailing 8 points clear, and Gattuso taking on the government. Plus, in our retro section, Popes, Porsches, and 3 days in a coma. It's the life and times of Gigi Lentini. Hello, everybody. Hello, James Horncastle.
Hey, James.
And hello, Dr. Gabriele Marcotti.
Great to be with you. I'm hyped. I'm amped. I'm so psyched to talk about Gigi Lentini because it brings up Torino 91-92, the last great distinctly Italian football team.
That's interesting. Gareth Stringer, we have to thank for providing this week's subject. I would still love a golazzo, says Gareth, on the life and times of Gigi Lentini. And bingo. I hope you're going to enjoy this, Gareth. Let's set the DeLorean to 1993, and boom, off we go. Chiuso in camera e non vuoi mangiare, stringi forte a te il cuscino e piangi e non lo sai quanto altro male ti farà la solitudine. It is 1993, the 2nd of August. La Solitudine by Laura Pausini is the soundtrack for young lovers all over the peninsula. And on the highway to Turin, a Porsche lies in flames, its young driver sprawled across the central reservation. He is Gigi Lentini, the most expensive footballer in the world. I guess you're wondering, how did I get here? Well, Gabriele, it all goes back to the Philadelphia in Turin.
That's right. Gigi Lentini, who, of course, hails from the south of Italy, Calabria, I think.
Yeah. Well, he was born in Turin, but well, before you start
his
with your agenda.
His parents moved to Turin in the 60s from
they're
Calabria.
From, yeah, okay.
And they're from, which, again, not to go back into his 1960s, economic boom in Italy, Fiat needing people from the south. A lot of people in Turin trace their history back to that. Mm-hmm. And he comes up and he belonged to the era of sort of the powerful winger, I think, more so than anything else.
He also belongs to the era of, well, one of the greatest production lines of Italian talent that existed in Il Calcio, Torino and their Philadelphia, no?
Well, also they have a talent scout at the time, who I think also Vatta. Worked for Vatta, Sergio Vatta, who was responsible for not only bringing through the likes of Lentini, but I think if we go back to another golazzo, we talk about Buffon. I think, obviously, he works on the Hermes Fulgoni, but when it came to being sort of a national coordinator and sort of identifying Gigi's talent at youth level, Vatta was also influential as that. Also, that the side that Totti was a part of, the Italy side. So, yeah, very influential guy who's probably not on a lot of people's radars, I think.
And now it all dried up and they just produce rubbish.
Right.
Well, youth level.
They closed down. I mean, the Torino closed down their youth academy, no?
It's amazing. I did a big project on this. The least productive part of Italy in terms of producing top flight footballers, once you adjust for per capita GDP and infrastructure and all those things, is Piedmont. It's absolutely shameful how one of the wealthiest areas of the country that's basically identical to the areas nearby, like Liguria or Lombardia, that, you know, do pull their weight in producing footballers,
is
produces
Naples,
almost nothing.
Is Campania the number one area?
On a per capita, like sort of footballers per million, it's Liguria.
Uh-huh.
Campania is the only area in the south that does well.
Uh-huh.
But there is sort of a belt, Campania, Lazio, Toscana, Emilia, and then Lombardia, but obviously that's more.
Okay. Liguria, the area around Genoa anyway.
But there's this big hole in Piedmont. Which I said, it's pretty appalling when you consider
Claudio Marchisio pulled himself out.
He's the only, he's one of the very few.
Okay. Well, back in those days, you had an incredible generation of talent coming through at Torino's Academy, the Philadelphia. And one of the stars, perhaps at the time, the greatest star, was Gigi Lentini, who was good enough to make his debut for the first team at the age of just 17 under Gigi Radice. I must admit, I would miss that he broke through that early in 1986. They sent him away for a while to Fare le Ossa to kind of build up a little bit of his strength. And he comes back, and Torino are in Serie B at the time. They come up to Serie A under the great and much-missed Mondonico, Emiliano Mondonico.
Who'd feature regularly throughout Lentini's career, not only at Torino, but later Atalanta and Cosenza as well.
And that Torino side, with a bit of money spent on it, has a couple of unbelievable seasons. Their first season up, they finished fifth. That's the 1991 campaign. And then 91-92, they have an now unthinkable third place finish. I mean, they're in the title race, and they're the woodwork away from winning the UEFA Cup final.
That's right. In fact, that summer, when they had their sort of their campaign, and then again, younger listeners, bear in mind, this is a time when we were kings, when Serie A was outspending everybody, and you had, you know, just the greatest talents in the world all playing in Italy. And Torino, who, you know, they had some money, but probably maybe sixth, seventh, eighth in terms of budget, they just put together this incredible side that went on the run. And that summer they had these ads that said, terzi in Italia, third in Italy, secondo in Europa, second in Europe, primi nel mondo, first in the world. Which in many ways they were, because I have memories of this incredible team. And, you know, in midfield, you had Martin Vasquez and teamed up with Enzo Schifo, the Belgian legend. Also, of course, the son of immigrants. You had a young Christian Vieri on the bench who contributed little or nothing. Did this guy Policano on the wing who was just sort of this big, horsey, galloping left back who'd go and just belt it. I mean, I think you can find some of the highlights of his goals on YouTube. Up front, you had Walter Casagrande, who is this Brazilian striker who would later become famous for really fat. And
he was huge. He looked a bit like Andre the Giant.
Also had a big coke problem later in his career.
Oh, with Pato Aguilera.
I bumped into him, actually. He became a very successful pundit on television. I bumped into him in Brazil, actually. We shared a lift, and there wasn't much room left. And at the back, one of my favorite characters from Italian football.
Pasquale Bruno.
I have to tell the Pasquale Bruno. I mean, Hearts fans, I know there's many who listen to us, will, of course, remember him. Pasquale Bruno, of course, the ultimate nasty, hard man.
But real sweetheart off the field. I spent a little bit of time with him and his family. He was the nicest guy. But on the field, he was, you know, as his name suggested, an animal. And do you remember that time when he tried to take the referee apart? And funnily enough, it was Lentini. It was one of the earliest instances of a top knot that I can remember in football.
Oh, yeah?
It's Lentini, the slender, gazelle-like figure of Lentini, who's holding Bruno back.
Stefano Tacconi, the Juve goalkeeper, because he also played for Juve, of course, tells a story that he used to room with Pasquale Bruno. And sometimes Tacconi couldn't sleep, and he'd wake up, and Pasquale Bruno would be sitting up in bed, and he'd be staring at the television, which was off, and he would just be fixating on, you know, the standby light, the little red light in the dark. And he looked at him, and he said, do I say something? Like, what the hell are you doing? Or do I just kind of turn around and pretend it never happened? He was intense. The guy was intense and had issues. No, the other guy I was going to mention is Roberto Cravero.
Okay.
So, because when I said that
He didn't have a top knot.
No. And eventually later he lost all his hair too and became really ugly.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah.
But when I say this was like the last sort of successful, stereotypically Italian team, and again, it's fitting that it was a Mondonico side. Cravero was a sweeper, but he was one of those sort of sweepers who really didn't defend. He wasn't a defender. He was just literally a guy who stood back there, who's slow, like he was like as slow as La Mole in Turin, in the sense he didn't really move. But he would kind of stand behind everybody and just get the ball, and he would start passing it around from the back. And I know it sounds, I'm not doing it justice, but a character like that could not exist in the modern game. You had Luca Marchegiani.
That's right. Cravero and Marchegiani would later go down, of course, to the capital to join
Lazio.
But Marchegiani, what a great keeper he was. Luca Fusi in
there
as well.
The aristocratic Luca Marchegiani. Yeah. Luca Fusi, of course, who had had the honor of playing with Maradona in Naples. We should mention Enrico Annoni, a.k.a. Tarzan, since he wasn't the only guy from that team to go on to play in Scotland.
Was he called Tarzan because of his hair?
I never knew why he was called Tarzan.
Right, he didn't have hair, basically.
Yeah, when he left Roma, he paid for a big banner, which read Tarzan, thanks the fans for their support and everything. And
right,
so it was Tarzan and this guy Silvano Benedetti, who's a sort of very sort of aristocratic looking blonde guy. They were the center backs, and Cravero was a sweeper, and you had the beastly Policano down the wing,
and the man at the heart of a lot of their exploits in Europe, that season as they went past Real Madrid in the UEFA Cup to make it to that two-legged final was Gigi Lentini.
Valentini, punta accendo. Scattasi a fondo campo, Valentini, il cross, la palla è per Fusi, e c'è gol di Fusi, 2-0 per il Torino, 2-0 per il Torino.
And then who did they meet in that UEFA Cup final, 1992?
One of Gab's favourites, Louis van Gaal.
Yeah. Hardly Louis van Gaal, and his Ajax team, which, again, you go back and you see how absolutely loaded with talent that Ajax side was. You know, from Clarence Seedorf to Edgar Davids to a young Canu, who might have been old back then, but we will never know, to a couple of De Boers, to Reitziger, to Jari Litmanen.
Yeah. Danny Blind, Aaron Vincent, Dennis Bergkamp, Brian Roy. on the bench, there's Van der Sar.
Yeah. You know, this Torino
Van der Sar, you can't get in the side.
This Torino team basically has a 2-2 with them in Turin, in which Lentini sets up Casagrande. And then it's 0-0 in Amsterdam, but I think they hit the woodwork three times, Torino, but come away empty-handed, and that's kind of the high point.
But I mean, that was one of the most iconic moments of that era in Italy, and particularly Torino history, which is full of kind of tragedy and misfortune, of Mondonico raising his chair in protest. Now, and I think was it a year ago when Mondonico passed away? That at his funeral, everyone did that.
Nice gesture. That proved the high water mark of that Torino side, because what with the Tangentopoli affair, that's overwhelming all aspects of Italian society, and with the fact that Lentini is such a prized possession, a young, skillful, homegrown, very multi-person. I mean, he can play on either side. He's got, I mean, what the talents that made him stand out, Gab, what would you say?
He was very fast, but he was very powerful when he ran down the wings. I mean, he had sort of that reedy-like strength. He was a good finisher, and
if you look back at some of his goals, a lot of them are headers, just him appearing at the far post.
Yeah. And he created mismatches, because obviously he had the size against fullbacks. You know, if you put a bigger guy on him, he'd run past them. If you put a smaller guy on him, he'd out-muscle them. You know, he really was one of those sort of early prototype wingers. He had a bag of tricks.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I'm going to go for another cult hero, although he's not Italian. In some ways, he had a little bit of the Joaquin about him. With some of his tricks, but then in other ways he was more like Luis Figo. So yeah, I mean, I know I'm hyping him to no end, and
but so this was the summer of 1992, and Borsano has to sell. The club have got huge debts, and just a bit of context here. It's a crazy summer. I mean, you were talking about back when we were kings. I mean, this was crazy. You had Milan, who'd come off a perfect season. They hadn't lost the previous campaign in Serie A, which was Fabio Capello's first year in charge. You had Juve, who were keen to get back on top, and the two of them have this kind of transfer war. Juve buy Gianluca Vialli from Sampdoria for 12 million, which was, I think, a world record at the time, breaking the world record that had just been set by Milan, who brought in the Ballon d'Or, Jean-Pierre Papin, to Milanello. Oh, and just to put this in perspective, those figures, right, which now sound like nothing in particular, do you know what the English transfer record was at the time?
£2.3 million. It was Gary Pallister to Manchester United. Keith Curl?
No, I was going to say Alan Shearer. I think that year
it was 3.1 million?
Yeah, 3.5 maybe. But it was in the threes.
Right.
And this is like four times that, three times in one summer, the Italian clubs are doing. Because then Juve and Milan go up against each other for Lentini.
But Lentini could never join Juventus.
Yeah.
So he ends up getting into Berlusconi's helicopter instead of Agnelli's Fiat.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you have the pound equivalent?
Well,
at the time,
people said £13 million, and this was a world record, and it caused...
So four times Alan Shearer.
The Pope. What did the Pope say, James?
I can't remember exactly what the Pope said.
It was an offence to, I think, the principles of hard work.
Profanity.
Yeah, exactly. And had he known how much they actually paid, I can imagine he would have been even more upset, because the early 90s was when, you know, traditionally you paid one figure on paper, and then you also gave the other club a hotel in Baldanecchio or whatever, as they did with Dino Baggio. But in this case, I think the actual figure is estimated to be around a third again. So it's about 20 million is probably the actual figure.
The other figure, of course, was paid off the books, which later landed a whole bunch of people in trouble.
Except,
although, funnily enough, not you-know-who.
Well, yeah, this was the extraordinary coincidence. So this, so Galliani and Berlusconi were both basically in trouble because of this fact that, yeah, somebody looked at the books and went, hang on, there's all this like black money that's been paid. But when Berlusconi took power the second time, the first, literally the first thing the government did was pass a law decriminalising false accounting. And so it was that in 2001, basically the whole thing was just wiped clean.
Maybe it was Lee Yong-hong's money.
Perhaps so. Extraordinary. Now you've got Lentini, who's the most expensive footballer in the world. Apparently he didn't want to leave Torino. He says that Berlusconi sent the helicopter to pick him up and bring him to Arcore, his kind of legendary estate outside of Milan, where he explained to him that the deal was already done and that was that. And so off to Milan, Lentini went.
He says that Berlusconi flew his helicopter to come and see him, and he turned him down initially. So I don't understand, you know, what happened there, whether you see Berlusconi kind of opening the door with the choppers kind of going, and he's just like, no. I ain't coming. But this is the classic thing where owners who have to sell end up presenting players as kind of traitors and mercenaries, isn't it? Where he's like, you know, I didn't want to go.
Torino fans, though, they kind of broadly saw through this. And in fact, shortly thereafter, Borsano was in a restaurant in central Turin. Word got around, and this was before Twitter and social media and for mobile phones, even unless you had those big shoe phone things. And the crowd gathered and said he was inside. And when it came time for him to leave, he was showered with coins and insults. He needed a police escort. He went back inside to hide. And it kind of mirrored what had happened with the end of the First Republic and your pal Bettino Craxi.
92-93, Channel 4 just starting its coverage. And there is, in this all-star Milan team, Gigi Lentini. His first season at Milan, there's the burden of the price tag. It's a pretty difficult side to even get into, but he gets 30 appearances, scores 7 goals. It's not...
Scores in the derby.
Mm-hmm. It was to prove probably his best ever, because just ahead of the second season, on the night of the 2nd of August 1993, he's returning from this preseason friendly down in Genoa, driving extremely fast in his Porsche. He has a blowout on his tyre. He changes the tyre. He puts on, you know, that little mini tyre that they have for emergencies.
The donut, the one that says, do not to be driven at speeds of above 30 miles an hour.
Exactly.
That one, James?
Yeah. And he does about 200 kilometres an hour on it. And
it's about 120 miles an hour, yeah.
And why is he in such a hurry, James?
Because he might be going to see Rita Schillaci, which is not related to Toto. It's Toto's wife.
Right. So she was in Turin, and she confirms this story. I mean, this was always the story at the time, but she confirms this now, huh?
Yeah, I mean, she was talking about it, only last month, I think, that, she was with Toto Schillaci until, I think, 1995. This is 93. Lentini talks about he felt that their relationship was already over, that it was okay for them to go, but they weren't having an affair. They were just going about it this way. And she came to see him in hospital after this this accident. So she wasn't hiding in any way from it. But
Her relationship with Toto, she said, was had gone to a dark place. Had become obsessive, which is hard to imagine with Toto.
I would have imagined, yes, of all people, that guy.
So anyway, there
she
is.
She said in this interview in October that it was to get back at Toto. This was out of spite. Yeah,
that's why she hooked up with the younger Gigi Lentini, who's doing his best to get back to Turin to see her, but ultimately loses control. The car ends up a complete wreck in flames. He's somehow thrown clear, probably. Nobody knows how, but he ends up lying in the central reservation and is found there by a truck driver who parks his camion across the road to stop anybody else coming in, and he gets taken off to hospital, and it's kind of touch and go for a while, but he spends as I recall 3 days in a coma, and the result of that is he pretty much has to relearn everything in terms of motor functions and stuff. He was out for the whole of, I think he came back for one game at the end of the next season, but he was never the same player again.
No, he had some okay seasons after that when he kind of moved down a level, but yeah, it wasn't the same. I think also kind of pop psychology, but people have sort of suggested that when you see your own sort of mortality questioned to that degree and you go back, some people either go all out and play every game as if it were their last, and others kind of...
There's more to life.
...withdraw and say there's more to life and hold something back.
Yeah, because, I mean, he said that he was sick of people saying that he was no longer the same after the accident.
Mm.
And he was like, well, for me, where my kind of passion, enthusiasm for football ended was in the 95... Was it the final against Ajax in Vienna?
Oh, yeah.
Where he said he felt he was back in form, should have been starting. He only comes on in the final 5 minutes of that game.
Well, this was his big chance for revenge, of course, in a European final against Ajax, the team that had cost his Torino.
Given who his manager was at the time, Fabio Capello, always known for such sentimentality,
well, that's the thing.
That he didn't indulge him.
You know, everyone always says the coma did for him, but was it the fact that when he came back, it was Capello, not
the most...
You
look at Capello's face every day?
Well.
But no, I mean, he does say that. After that, he was just like, football, it's a job. It's not my life.
So he leaves Milan and Capello at that point in what, 96, I think, the following season, goes to rejoin Emiliano Mondonico at Atalanta, and then goes back to Torino in 1997, where he hooks up with all sorts of interesting people, including...
Tony DiRigo.
Graham Souness.
Who tried once to pass in the ball and get it back, but never got it back, and then gave up passing in the ball, according to Tony.
And this, again, follows another theme in sort of his history with Torino of hitting the woodwork, because DiRigo misses... the penalty for them to get promoted against Perugia in what is essentially a playoff, which...
ends up turning into sort of a mega brawl in the dressing room.
Oh, is this when you... The Materazzi challenge?
Macelazzi.
There's a horrible two-footed Materazzi challenge on him that's... Oh.
Yeah. There's a great YouTube clip of the challenge, which is horrendous. Mm. I mean, two-footed into his ribs. And after the game, Lentini's complains, like, you know, if we had sort of retrospective actions, they would have seen I've been elbowed in the face twice at set pieces by Materazzi. Before this challenge, he tried to kill me. And then basically he takes me out, stretch it on, and he pulls his shirt up. And I mean, it's like he's got puncture wounds. He's got he's got studs run down his leg.
I say is respect the matrix. Seriously. With all the money that this guy made, with the fact that I don't want to be unkind, but the whiny, whingy, there's a referee there to do a job. Materazzi in the early part of his career might have been a little bit overenthusiastic with some of his challenges, but Lentini could also dish it out too.
Okay, so he does manage to bring Torino up and has a nice spot, as you mentioned, with Graham Souness.
Mm.
That didn't work out so well. I met him at that time, and he was a changed person by his experiences, and I think was weary of the whole price tag business, as you mentioned, weary as well of trying to compete with a tool, in a sense, his body, that didn't do what it used to do. So I think that would distance you, would kind of dim your enthusiasm for the whole thing. But he seemed kind of happy enough, and that's kind of how his career went. He just kind of like drifted further and further away from the limelight.
There's one stage where he takes like almost a year out. After Torino, and then he decides to go back to Calabria.
I'd forgotten that.
And plays for Cosenza.
Right, and they go all the way down to Serie D.
Yeah,
but he stays with them.
Yeah, I mean they almost get promoted to the top flight. I think Mondonico is the manager again there. Then they survive, and then they basically go bust. They go under. He's captain of the team. They have to completely start from the bottom, and he decides to stick with them, and that's one of the reasons why he's a bit of a Cosenza legend.
Right.
And it's also part of the reason why it is relevant that when we mentioned where he's from,
right,
a lot of people in Italy are often very attached to their roots. And even though he grew up in Turin and was born in Turin, his family's in Turin, he also had strong ties to sort of his ancestral home.
When you look at the way that he made the headlines in the early 90s, and then particularly with that transfer to Milan, it's tempting to classify him as his career as a failure, essentially. I mean, he never did anything internationally. I mean, Italy didn't get to the 92 Euros, which I guess would have been his big chance.
Oh, no, and he talks about the big regret of that car accident is he misses out on the 94 World Cup.
Right.
And he played some of the qualifiers between 92 and 94, obviously missed most in 93, but
right,
felt that he had a real shot of being a part of that squad and maybe contributing to
it. Would have been interesting to see.
Mm.
Yeah.
I've thought about this many times.
Okay.
The thing is, it was Baresi and Baggio who missed the penalties.
Right.
Those were Italy's two best penalty takers. So it really wouldn't have made a difference.
Maybe it wouldn't have gone to penalties.
Yeah. Arrigo Sacchi was the manager. I'm not sure that he would have played that much.
Okay. Well, he would have been part of a World Cup squad. And people now would probably think of Lentini as being something other than the £13 million most expensive footballer in the world who wiped out on a highway on the way to see someone else's wife, amongst other things. The point is, I guess, that he seems happier now than he was back then. He's running his restaurant stroke billiard hall.
Yeah, as we mentioned, he's taking part in his snooker tournaments around the around the area in which he lives.
It's not really snooker, though, is it?
Nah, no.
His son plays, I don't know what level, but is a goalkeeper, intriguingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a very philosophical take on it all. He says, prima o poi il pallone si sconfia e tu torni ad essere un comune mortale come ce ne sono tanti. The ball, it's a big inflated thing, and sooner or later it goes down for everybody and you end up just like everybody else. So there you go. Gigi Lentini, for a while, he certainly wasn't like anybody else. But welcome to the pack, Gigi. Right, let's talk about what's going on with the current crop of overinflated superstars in Serie A after this. Busy weekend as Il Campionato Più Bello del Mondo returned to action after the international break. All the players taking the field with a dab of red paint on their cheeks to protest against violence against women, which is a nice touch.
Mm-hmm. They did it last year as well.
This weekend saw Juve go 8 points clear at one end of the table. And yay, Chievo earning another point at the other, Gab. They're now just 10 points from safety. They're coming.
No, they're not.
This is after they held Napoli 0-0 at San Paolo. What on earth happened there?
Napoli created more chances. They couldn't finish them. Sorrentino made some great saves, and the pitch didn't help. And
Insigne also missed a bit of a sitter.
It wasn't just Insigne. Yeah, Insigne
but was bad. He hit the post.
Insigne was bad, but it's just one of those days.
Okay. But a good day for Mimmo Di Carlo,
the new manager. Match in charge,
They're no longer pointless.
They are no longer pointless.
Mm.
So, and a good weekend in general for...
I might dispute that, but anyway.
A good weekend
also, they helped out Juventus, which I'm not sure, you know, again, does Chievo any favours.
Another new manager, Davide Nicola, who took over at Udinese, got his tenure there off to a winning start with a 1-0 win over Roma, which would be a surprise, except that just Roma keep on doing this.
Tremendous goal, though, from Rodrigo De Paul.
He's one of the informed players. Well, one of the players of the season so far, I'd say, in Serie A.
I'm surprised they haven't. I thought they were going to cash in on him.
Well, there's an offer from Fiorentina on the table. In the summer there was. And I think they were holding out for more.
There's a lot of people saying that that's the player that Milan need, and we'll come on to Milan and their issues are otherwise very shortly. But just to say that, what is it with Roma, though, that they can't beat teams from the bottom six?
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned that, James. I mean, they've taken just a point from games against Chievo, Bologna, Spal, and Udinese, which teams you'd expect them to be cleaning up against. I mean, just to put the game on Saturday night in some perspective, Udinese had taken a point from the last seven games. They hadn't scored at home since September. And look, Davide Nicola kind of stayed true with the system that Velasquez had, but completely different sort of approach in that he added a more kind of physical body in midfield in Berami just to completely clean out Lorenzo Pellegrini. Went strikerless, didn't play Kevin Lozano, so he had De Paul and Pussetto, who he's impressing me, that Ignacio Pussetto.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got quite agile guys. When they broke quite well. Roma, they have a hard time creating clear-cut chances, hard time scoring, and it just, I think, with them, they're always looking, if they can get the first goal, then that's when it really suits them, because teams start to come out and they've got more space to play. And instead, you know, you look at all the kind of, you know, Di Francesco cites this after every game, you know, we had 26 shots and all this sort of thing. 25 of them are from outside the box.
Yeah, the XG isn't great if you're Di Francesco, especially as James says, like when the score's deadlocked or they're behind, they end up just taking a lot of... And Di Francesco, he always encourages players to try and do something individual and so on to get an edge. But if you don't pull it off, you get afternoons like the one against Udinese.
Well, he may end up an ex-manager if this continues. So that feeling seems to be building still in the capital. frustration with the lack of success.
Paulo Sousa is actually saying he wants the job.
Yeah. Well, he's, it's strange. I mean, he came out some time ago and said this. Now.
A couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. Campionato di calcio italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. Sunday night, James, you went to, or Sunday evening, you went to the Stadio Olimpico for Lazio Milan, which ended up a 1-1 draw. Good game?
I think good games may be a bit of a stretch. I mean, I was impressed by Milan relative to where they're at now, which is I was expecting Lazio to win this game because I think you're not going to get a better opportunity to beat a side like Milan, given that they had so many players out injured.
Yeah.
The spine of the team was not there. Romagnoli, Biglia, and also Higuain was suspended.
Bonaventura. Mm-hmm. He's got so many centre backs out that he played 3-4-3 with freaking Christian Zapata.
Ignacio Abate.
Abate, who, I don't know, other than run fast, relatively fast, I don't know what he does. Mm. And Ricardo Rodriguez is another one of those guys who, you know, talking about atypical, like he's another one who's the size of a house and he plays left back slowly. And I guess just because he's tall, like, oh, let's put him in the middle. And yet somehow it worked. And then Kessie, I thought, was good. Bakayoko mm-hmm. was good in midfield. And I mean, I don't know, you were there, but if Donnarumma has an average game, Milan lose this heavily, right?
Yeah. No, without doubt.
And I mean, if Clever clogs...
Simo.
Ooh, 25 minutes to go. Ooh, oh, a draw is a good result. Let me take off Luis Alberto and SMS, Milinkovic-Savic, because, you know, they haven't done anything yet. And let me go and send a signal that we're happy with a draw. And, you know, 1980s are over, dumbass.
Is Simone Inzaghi.
This is the thing that Inzaghi has to prove in my eyes, mm-hmm. is that...
He knows anything? He's better than his brother, yeah, okay.
But the thing that's stopping them from getting into the Champions League is they have a horrendous record in these big games. You know, I mean, that's ultimately what cost them in May last year when their destiny is in their hands to get into the Champions League. And they end up shooting themselves in the foot, out-choking Inter, which is saying something. That's what I was saying. This was a golden opportunity for them to basically take advantage of this moment that Milan are going through.
This was the big duel between fourth and fifth.
He settled for the draw.
He
sends on his Jordan Lukaku, who, you know, for Milinkovic-Savic, and I forget what the other guy he brought on was, but...
Joaquin Correa got the equaliser in the 94th
minute. Well, then that kind of puts his changes in perspective.
No, it doesn't, because it's 0-0 when he brings them on, and then Milan score. And then at the end, Correa pulls his shot out of nowhere, also because, you know, I mean, by that point, they're exhausted.
Uh-huh.
And as I'm sure we'll talk about, Gattuso was absolutely crucified by certain people for not making any substitutions.
So after the game, which Milan, given all the absences, Higuain and pretty much all their defenders, did pretty well out of to get a point away at Lazio. Matteo Salvini, the vice president and the minister of the interior.
Yes.
Yeah. Basically...
calls up Teo Lombardia. Let's have a chat about what happened in Rome today.
He's the co-prime minister. Italy theoretically have a prime minister, but...
Call him the vice president? Yeah, so deputy prime minister.
Not really, because... Well, I think they might be that too, but he and this other guy, Di Maio, effectively are co-prime ministers. They have this guy who's just a figurehead named Conte. No relation, as far as we know. I'd rather actually the other Conte was in charge, and that's saying a lot. So because he doesn't have much on his plate, he went to the game, and then, of course, what does he do? He's sitting at home eating a sandwich, watching, and he calls up to... Actually, how did he get back to Milan quickly enough to call up Tele Lombardia, or was he still in Rome?
Yeah, he must have been still in Rome. It's impossible because it was 5 o'clock on
Sunday.
You can't
get Tele Lombardia in Rome.
Yeah, but he calls them up.
Oh, so he's not even watching the show when he decides
Maybe they called him. But anyway, so he basically then takes Gattuso to task.
Yeah, and says that, why is he playing Borini? My grandma's better than Borini. I don't have a coaching license, but I could do a better job than Gattuso right now. In fact, anyone who's not at home cooking their pasta for their family could do a better job than Gattuso. And Gattuso, quite rightly, in the press conference afterwards, says, I think you've got bigger problems to deal with now. Mm. Shouldn't you be running
Italy? I, as an Italian, would have one or two things to say to you, Mr. Salvini.
Well, the other thing is, look at who was on the bench for Milan.
Right.
I thought, other than maybe Laxalt to have a pair of fresh legs to run around, although, you know, he was just on international duty, There's nobody you could have brought on. I mean, they're all corpses. That's what he had all these dudes nobody's ever heard of. And people like Mauri and Bertolacci, who I don't think have played football in years. Montolivo was on the naughty step. So what are you going to do?
The other thing that Salvini came out with was he weighed in on the whole question of Ibrahimovic, whose return to Milan does seem to be getting more and more concrete by the day. He said basically he didn't think that Milan needed Ibrahimovic. Their problems were actually in the middle of the field. They needed somebody like De Paul.
Yeah, although De Paul doesn't play
for Milan, so
will Ibra play for Milan?
I don't know. The one thing which makes me slightly suspicious about this, and I'm going to give you a little insight in how the media works. So you open Gazzetta dello Sport, was it Tuesday last week, and you have 3 pages of like, oh, Ibra's available, and this is what it would cost, and this is how to do it, and these little things, and like, these are Ibra and Mrs. Ibra's favorite restaurants in Milan, and like, this is their dog, and well, wouldn't it be great if he came back? Oh, remember the time, you know, Beckham came back to Milan? And I'm like, this is all Ibrahimovic offering himself to Milan. And it got to the point where they were writing it in such a way that some websites in this country said that it's, you know, here in England, it says, oh, it's a done deal. He's joining Milan and he's going to get paid this much and whatever. But, you know, at that point, Leonardo's like, I think he actually came out and he said, like, well, he hasn't called me and I haven't called him, you know. So
do you think Leonardo wants him?
No, I don't. I mean,
they've got other priorities, surely. I mean, I think when they had everyone fit, Gattuso was moving towards them playing 4-4-2 with Higuain and Cutrone. Now, the problem is they don't really have anyone to back up those guys unless Fabio Borini basically comes back and starts playing as a striker. The issue that they've got is centre-back with all these injuries at the moment and in midfield where with Bilia out, they don't have anyone who can sort of organise their play, get their passing game going. Out wide, they've got the players they need. They've got Souza, they've got Calhanoglu, who had probably had his best game this season. It wasn't great, but better than any outing so far this year.
Hit the woodwork.
So, you know, I think they've got other priorities than Zlatan.
This feels like a big Raiola power play. And it's going to be interesting to see, I think, how Milan react. Because, obviously, unless they can package something where they, I don't know, send Higuain back and that loan fee, which isn't going to happen. I don't think it can even happen legally. It would be so out of kilter with the new regime, which is all about sort of, you know, not just building organically, but really maximizing and monetizing their stars. You know, you're not going to go and commercialize Ibrahimovic for 6 months.
Seems very Galliani.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, no.
Okay. So 1-1 draw Sunday evening, and then straight after that, the riot of colour at the Marassi that was the Genoa derby, Genoa-Sampdoria, finished 1-1. Glorious scenes beforehand. It just looked great, the Luigi Ferraris, for that. But the two teams stay 4 and 5 points off the drop.
And one other thing about Genoa, just because for those who you couldn't have missed it if you were on social media at all, obviously Boca and River were supposed to play in the Libertadores final on Saturday and then Sunday, and the return leg's been postponed again. I think it was the mayor of Genoa offered, look, if you decide that you're going to play this game outside of Argentina, somewhere else, why don't you come and play it in Marassi, given that both clubs were founded by immigrants from Genoa. In fact, Boca are known as Genesi, which means people from Genoa. Obviously, I hope that they can play the match at the Monumental and it's full and nothing bad happens. But if they decide that they really don't have the condition of the plate abroad, rather than going and playing it in the desert in Abu Dhabi, has been suggested by some.
Well, as a forerunner to the World Clubs Cup, not?
Yeah, because one of these, obviously the winner is going to play in the Club World Cup. I said, wow, Genoa wouldn't be so bad. It's about halfway between Abu Dhabi and Buenos Aires. Food for thought.
I suppose it is. Very nice. Okay, well, we'll wait to see what happens about that. Meantime, that's it for this edition of Golazzo. Next week, if there's anything you'd like us to talk about in particular in that or a future edition of Golazzo, at AC Jimbo is a good place to do it, or at The Totally Show. James, look forward to seeing you next week.
Yes.
Also you, Dottore.
Yes, absolutely.
And you, listener. For now, from all of us here, it's Arrivederci. Campionato di calcio italiano.
You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.